This is Vermont Edition. I'm Nina Keck in for Jane Lindholm, who's on maternity leave. Vermont, like every state, is grappling with the rising cost of incarceration. According to a report issued by the Vera Institute of Justice, in 2010, the total cost of Vermont's prisons and jails exceeded $111 billion. And that doesn't take into account the social costs to those who have family members in prison. In 2006, Vermont launched an innovative restorative justice program called COSA. That stands for Circles of Support and Accountability. In the program, community volunteers are trained and put into teams of 3 to 5 people. These teams meet weekly with an offender for at least a year to support that person as he or she returns to the community. It's a big time commitment, but one that seems to be working. Here to talk more about the program is Derek Miodovnik, the Community and Restorative Justice Executive for the Vermont Department of Corrections, and Kathy Fox. She's a criminologist and associate professor of sociology at the University of Vermont. She was hired by the Department of Corrections to assess the COSA program, and her report came out last month. Kathy Fox and Derek Miodovnik, welcome to Vermont Edition.
Thank you very much for having us.
Thanks.
So in reading about the COSA program, I understand that it originated in Canada in the 1990s as a way to deal with high-risk sex offenders. So Derek Miodovnik, how did it end up in Vermont?
So you're absolutely right. This was a grassroots community-based response to a high risk. When we say high risk in corrections language, we mean somebody who's understood to be likely to reoffend. And the grassroots community response was to put some relationships around this individual. And at that point, Vermont had already established, through what we call community justice centers, a capacity locally for citizen engagement with individuals who'd broken the law. And we had done this with people who'd done low-level criminal activity and had formed things called reparative boards. And so we already had within our state a really important local capacity for citizens engaging with people who've done harm. And we had a federal grant that we received in 2002 that was part of something called the Serious and Violent Offender Reentry Initiative. And it looked at how states could improve how to have people who are more serious offenders come back successfully. And so we looked to our community-based capacity and our justice centers and began to look at how might they engage. And it was our justice centers who found this model.
So it seemed like it was a natural fit then for Vermont, since we had a lot of the substructure was already there.
That's absolutely right.
So Kathy Fox, your background as a criminologist, gave you a unique perspective on judging this program. Before we get into the nuts and bolts of the study that has just been released, talk about what intrigued you about this program to begin with.
Well, part of it was that when I came to Vermont, I understood that they had this community justice infrastructure that was unique in the country. And Vermont is the only state that has this structure. And that they were doing these restorative panels and things like that. So when I heard about the reentry piece of it, that they were using those, I became very interested in it because I'm passionate about offender reintegration, partly because, and the federal funds were developed because of the fact that in the U.S. we have very high reoffense rates. And the federal government decided that they needed to start paying attention to that on the other end. After we incarcerate all these people, what happens to them and how do we help them to reintegrate and not reoffend? So I was very interested in how to have better outcomes, how better outcomes could be achieved.
Well, let's talk about how the program actually works. Derek Miodovnik, can you paint a picture or tell us about a particular offender who's taken part just so we can understand the way it all fits together?
Absolutely, sure. So again, the COSA model is really intended for folks who represent a potential to do harm and that really do need support and accountability and that they don't want to commit offenses again. So it's important when we talk about this program to understand that this is a program that individuals aren't required to participate in. They're not coerced into it. It's for people who are saying, I'm going to need some additional help in order to be, a successful community member. And we identify those folks internally while they're still incarcerated. Our case workers in the prisons know this program now, and they know who the target population for it is, and they communicate with the local office in the field, the probation office, where this person will eventually be released, and then those two entities communicate with the local justice center, and we have 20 different community justice programs around the state. So we have a statewide capacity that allows us to identify the appropriate individuals, connect them with a local justice program, and then begin to see if that person really wants more people in their life and is up for that commitment.
Listeners, have you ever participated in a restorative justice program like COSA? Has someone in your family been incarcerated and then struggled with repeat offenses? We'd love to hear your thoughts on this issue. 1-800-639-2211, the number to call if you'd like to ask our guests a question or have a comment to share. Again, that's 1-800-639-2211, or you can post a comment on our webpage. That's vpr.net/Vermont Edition. We got a comment from Pat. She writes, I've served on one COSA team for over a year and have just joined another one. Sometimes people assume a COSA is a group of do-gooders with an excessive concern for offenders and not enough appreciation for the harm done to victims. This is really a misunderstanding. I was a crime victim, she writes, and from my perspective, it's comforting to know that people are taking responsibility, making amends where they can, and getting supervision and support to safely re-enter the community. Conventional justice only offers the victim vengeance, and I can tell you from personal experience that really doesn't lead to healing. So, listeners, we'd like to read more of your comments, and we'll get to some of them. But again, our phone number, 1-800-639-2211. Kathy Fox, tell us about, you know, you looked at a lot of different offenders who'd gone through this program. Core members, I think, is how you identify them. Can you tell us about one particular story, again, to kind of illuminate how the program works?
Well, I have a lot of different stories, but one person in particular stands out in my mind as someone who served a long sentence for a very serious crime and was despondent and depressed, had no one on the outside, and felt certain that he would reoffend, even if in some small way, just to go back to something familiar. He was afraid to be out. He was afraid people would judge him. He was afraid of all kinds of different things. And then also just had sensory overload with the idea of getting out and going to the grocery store and doing things that, and the world had changed a lot in 20 years. And he was a little suspicious about what was the intention of these volunteers and all this extra supervision. And over time, he came to see these people as sort of a quasi-family almost, and he felt certain that he would have either committed suicide or gone back to jail without the support of the people.
What sorts of guidance or what sorts of advice, what was this committee helping this particular offender with?
Well, there were things like doing small things, like going to the grocery store and buying five things, just five things, you know, doing these little baby steps, learning how to use a cell phone, things like that. And then also mock job interviews, teaching basic sort of social skills like making eye contact, you know, asking people about their day. And then one of the things that I think is most important to mention is sometimes it's just sort of what ordinary life is like. Like, here's how you make a budget. Here's what people do for recreation. They go fishing. They go hiking. They do or they do community service. And sometimes teams would do community service altogether. And the thing that was the most powerful was for core members was that people, unpaid volunteers, were willing to spend time with them and believed that they were worthy of spending time with. And that made a huge impact on them.
Derek Majdovinik, you're nodding right now. Yeah. And that's something that I read in your study, too, Kathy Fox, that it was important. Derek, why do you think it meant more to the offenders that these folks were not paid correction staff, that they were just general folks in their own communities?
Well, I think because if you look at the other people, by and large, that are in the lives of the core members, there are a lot of professionals and probably not a lot of people that are just in their lives because they want to be. And I think that what we've heard through multiple voices of these core members is captured in Kathy's great report, is just that notion of because of the increased professionalism and focus on some level, ironically, the non-professional piece is that much more poignant and, frankly, transformational for this population.
All right. If you're just joining us, we're talking about an innovative program to help people who have been released from prison stay out of prison. The recidivism rate in Vermont is 40%, and a program called COSA, Circles of Support and Accountability, puts community volunteers with high-risk offenders. Today on Vermont Edition, we're talking about why that program seems to be working and how it might be expanded in Vermont. 1-800-639-2211, our phone number if you'd like to join in this conversation. Let's go to the phone lines now. Take a caller from West Haven. Hi, Joan. Welcome to Vermont Edition.
Hi. I'm currently a COSA member, and our core member has been with us for about 15 months since he's been out of jail, and we worked with him for about 6 months prior to his getting out of jail. It has been one of the most rewarding experiences of my life. My job when I was employed was at the Marble Valley Correctional Center, and for 11 or 12 years, I co-facilitated sex offender groups. So I know what the Department of Corrections can do and what they cannot do. And the COSA provides a service that is outside the Department of Corrections, and it really helps the offender. We can hold them accountable with compassion and with caring, and that's absolutely necessary. We form a relationship with a core member, and this particular core member confesses more to us than I've ever heard in my many years of working with offenders. It's been a wonderful experience both for him and for me. It's incredibly rewarding.
Joan, do you plan on doing more of the COSA programs?
I sure do. I've been asked to join another one, and I'm waiting to get the call.
And one other follow-up question. Did you feel like the training that you got as a volunteer, and you'd had some previous experience, I guess, working in a corrections facility, but as a volunteer, did you feel like the training you got adequately prepared you for the job?
I already knew the stuff in the training.
So that wasn't a factor?
No, that was not a factor for me personally.
All right. Well, thank you very much for the call. Kathy Fox, you wanted to comment.
Well, I asked people about the training that they received and what they felt about it, and they, if they were unprepared for anything in particular. And overwhelmingly, people felt that their training really did prepare them well for everything. The other thing that I think is important to mention is the community justice centers have reentry coordinators that really oversee and sort of monitor the COSA. So they provide ongoing training if an issue comes up. And they also, because they work in teams, they run ideas past each other. You know, it's not like a single volunteer is left on their own. There's a lot of support for them also.
All right, let's go back to the phone lines again. 1-800-639-2211. Our number here at Vermont Edition. Let's go to Bellows Falls and talk with Michael. Hi, Michael. Welcome to the program.
Hi. I just wanted to make a comment. I'm the coordinator for the Bellows Falls Justice Project here in town, and I just think that it's good you're putting this program on today, because I think throughout the state, the need for integration back into the community after a long jail sentence is really important, because I think we have a tendency to forget what these people may have been incarcerated for a long period of time and have very little support when they get out, and it's overwhelming for a large majority of them.
All right, Michael.
So I'm glad that I'm a part of this.
Excellent. Thanks for that call. I'd like to explain a little bit more about how the program works and get back to the whole training perspective for these volunteers. If you have somebody that calls you up and says, I'd like to take part, a neighbor of mine does this, what's the time commitment, first of all, and what sort of training? How does that part work?
Yeah, so it's a significant time commitment. There's a pre-service training that consists of about 12 hours. It usually takes place over the course of a Friday evening and a Saturday. We hold them every 8 weeks, and that training we rotate to different parts of the state each time we hold it, so that hopefully nobody ever has to wait too long before one's at a convenient location. The training itself really gets into, in some respects, how the same experience of changing behaviors really runs across the human experience, if you will. But the implications for these individuals' failure to change those behaviors is what is really important. And that's why COSA is really about public safety and no more victims. I mean, that's the goal and that's the motto, if you will, of COSA. And it takes a time commitment of, at a minimum, a COSA will get together once a week for a year. That's the standard definition for an hour. And then be available to the core member for calls during the week, a cup of coffee here, a fishing outing, you know, basically the kind of things that people who spend time with other people in a meaningful way do. But at a basic minimum, it's a 1 hour a week for a year. And I would encourage anybody who's thinking about this to think about the importance of your community's safety and the amazing resource that you have potentially available by the donation of that time. And that's the amazing thing, is that it's just people who make us all safe through this.
And what I think is really fascinating, Kathy Fox, in the report that you've done, I think in the study that I read, you admit that it's too small of a pool to really paint a broad picture of success. But talk about, when you really analyze the program, why do you think it works? And how well does it work?
I think it works very well. And it works the way it's intended to. And the data out of Canada show that it can reduce recidivism by around 70%. So which is phenomenal in correctional world. So one of the ways that it works is that, you know, a probation officer has a caseload. They only have so much time. And they, you know, they're doing monitoring, but they certainly don't have the time to walk somebody to the grocery store and things like that. So some of the just basic stabilizing factors, like everyday experience, they help with that. The other thing is that the COSA team can monitor risk. They see signs, little signs of risk, sooner than a probation officer would, who might be meeting with them once a week or, you know, once a month or whatever. So they see them. They know if they're starting to, you know, tell lies or do, you know, things that are so they have an ongoing open communication with the probation officer, and the core member knows that. So there's a lot more supervision, actually, of the person than someone who just gets released on standard probation. So that's one way, is that, you know, that risk is monitored earlier, and if there needs to be an intervention, then it can happen. That's one way it works in terms of monitoring them and holding them accountable. The way it works in terms of support is what many core members expressed, is the fact that volunteers were willing to spend time with them, that thought they were worthwhile human beings, and talk to them about, you know, yes, you can be an asset to the community. You can. Then they began to believe it, as opposed to people treating them like they were a marked person or, you know, a deficit to the community. Then they felt this sense of mutual obligation, like, I don't want to let my team down. And they began to believe in themselves. So I think that transformative piece, as Derek mentioned, is really cannot be underestimated.
All right. Well, we'll take more of your calls, get to more of your comments when we continue. I'm Nina Kekin for Jane Lindholm. This is Vermont Edition on Vermont Public Radio. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Nina Kekin, and today we're talking about an innovative volunteer-driven program that the state is using to lower recidivism among those newly released from prison. Kathy Fox, Associate Professor of Sociology at UVM, and Derek Miodovnik, the Community and Restorative Justice Executive for the Vermont Department of Corrections, are my guests today. I'd like now to bring in another voice to the conversation. Marion Drew is a volunteer with the Montpelier Community Justice Center. She currently serves on four different co. Marion Drew, thanks for talking with us today.
You're welcome. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, thanks. So, yeah. How did you first hear about the COSA program, and why did you decide to get involved?
Okay. Well, years ago, I was a guardian ad litem, and I was a guardian ad litem for a young boy who, when he turned 16, kept getting into little troubles. And so, at that point, they started what was really kind of a COSA for him, and then when it opened up and I met Yvonne, Judy, and Alfred, I signed on as a COSA volunteer because it really, I believe in reparative. I believe in them returning to the community and being worthwhile members. And one of the things that I go by is I have raised six sons, And one of the things that I noticed about immediately is that most of every one of these young men, except that they have offended and been caught, they're not a lot different than any other boys that I ever know. And but they, you know, definitely there was a problem there. So I decided to get involved in it. And once I started, I never looked back.
So what surprised you? You know, raising six boys gives you a huge amount of experience just in life skills. But what surprised you as you took part in that first COSA team?
What surprised me, I think, the most is how, quote, normal, except that they had, you know, at some point they had offended and they'd been caught and they'd been punished. But I realized after the first couple of meetings, they're no different than anybody else. And they are out among us. And I think probably one of the things that we like to say in the COSA is the primary thing is no more victims. And so that's how I settled on that. No more victims.
Mary and Drew, one of the things that Kathy Fox's report brought up that I thought was very interesting was not only are the offenders helped and recidivism is reduced, but the community volunteers say they benefit greatly. What have you gotten out of this program?
Oh, my goodness. First of all, every COSA that I have been on, we form a friendship among the COSA itself, and it's a friendship that I can't even explain it. It's based on mutual trust and watching the way they deal with these other people that have offended, and just knowing that we're all there to support this same person. We come from all different walks of life. I'm probably the oldest one. We have young people, but we all get along, and I think we form a friendship that will be life-lasting.
Awesome. Marion, hold on the line there. Stay on the line with us. I want to take a caller now. Let's go to Plainfield now and check in with Josh. Hi, Josh. You there?
Yeah, hi.
Hi. Welcome to Vermont Edition.
Oh, thank you so much. I've been listening to your show for quite a while, but I just wanted to say I was actually a core member through COSA in Montpelier, and it really is a great program. I think short of housing, that seemed to be kind of an issue, but they got me in real quick, and it was a wonderful program. Yvonne down at the Montpelier COSA, and Alfred and John, they're all really great people, and I think if more people could get involved with it, that would really help them out a lot. But
so, Josh, let me ask you a couple specifics. You said you were a core member, so you were getting out of prison. These folks were meeting you with once a week. Is there any specific thing, one or two specific things that really helped you as you were transitioning? And what might those two, one or two things be?
I think I got pretty lucky with the actual people that were in my COSA. They really were great people. I mean, I see people, you know, still involved with probation and parole. And, you know, I'm on parole now and see them about once a month. But the people in my group were fantastic. And the people that I've met that are doing COSA with other people have been really good. I think it's really just the bond that you make with the people that really makes you feel like, I think I actually heard somebody say it already, like, you don't want to let them down.
Yeah,
you
know, sure.
As well as your family.
So. And so you said now you're meeting with your COSA team members once a month versus once a week?
Oh, no. I actually just see them. I work at Hunger Mountain Co-op, and they come in. And I see them there. I see parole of my parole officer once a month now. It's pretty few and far between. And,
all right. Well, good.
It's about 3 years since I've had any incidents whatsoever.
Excellent.
And, hey, it really is just such a great program. I'm so glad you guys are doing a story on it.
Well, good. Thanks for calling in. I appreciate you taking the time, Josh. And good luck to you.
Thank you.
All right. Okay. Let's see if we can get another phone call in. Let's go to Burlington and talk with Frank. Hi, Frank. Go ahead.
Hi. I just wanted to call in and mention that the COSA program is amazingly helpful. I was incarcerated, no family in Vermont. Really no support, felt everything was stacked against me, and I was lucky enough to be accepted into the COSA circle and provided with the mainly emotional support that helped me get on my feet and get back into real life.
You mentioned, Frank, that you had no support. So did that COSA team member, did that team kind of provide the support that you didn't have?
They did. I mean, from everything from I'm having a hard day, can we have a cup of coffee, to I'm having a hard time finding a place to live, can you point me in the right direction?
Huh.
The big thing I think everyone needs to know about COSA is that it's not so much that they do things for you, is that they help you do them for yourself.
Excellent. Hey, Frank, I appreciate you taking time to check in today. I want to go back to Marion Drew. Marion, are you still there?
Yes, I am.
Well, let me just ask you as one final question. There might be folks listening out there that are interested. What kind of a person do you think is a good fit for volunteering with COSA?
I guess you have to be compassionate and non-judgmental, because if you start out and you're going to judge anybody on the offense that they had, I don't know that that would work. But anybody, I just think it's worth going to the training. If you have any interest, call the Montpelier Community Justice Center, speak with Judy, Yvonne, or Alfred, and definitely go to some of the trainings. It helps everybody. It helps a core member. It helps a COSA, and it means that these people that are out in the community who have offended have lots of extra eyes on them and support, and
sure,
that's huge.
All right. Well, Marion Drew, thank you so much. Marion Drew is a volunteer with the Montpelier Community Justice Center. She currently serves on four different COSAs. 1-800-639-2211, our number to call at Vermont Edition. Let me go back to the phone lines. We have a couple folks waiting. Let's go to Montpelier and talk with Dave. Hi, Dave. Thanks for calling today.
Good morning, all. Full disclosure, I'm an employee of the DOC for 35 years. I've directly supervised offenders. Thank you for the work that you do, and I fully support the program. And I think that this works, because if you can bring stable, responsible human beings into the lives of people who haven't always been responsible and stable, it's going to be a good thing, and it's going to work. And you alluded to the fact that staff don't always have time to do this and spend those quality time that you guys spend with offenders. And that's true. I did want to touch on two points, if I may.
Yeah, go ahead.
One is that I would like to see this work done preventatively, and it probably is in some venues, but before people are involved with the system, identifying risk factors and say, you know, I think this person could be on the road to the criminal justice system. Let's step in now and see what we can do.
Sure.
And because part of our mission is to prevent, and we forget that sometimes. So I'd like to see some part of the DOC move in that direction. The other thing that I wanted to point out is some of the offender advocates have correctly pointed out that it would be better if the DOC had a more stable workforce in the prisons. And I agree with that. And I am an employee advocate. And I just wanted to comment that as long as we're hiring correctional officers as temps without benefits and without sick days, that turnover and that instability,
sure,
is going to exist. And it's not going to be
beneficial. Let me jump in. I just want to give my guests a chance to respond. I appreciate you calling in. Derek Miodovnik, can you talk first about his point about preventative? I thought it was an interesting take.
Yeah, absolutely. Hey, Dave, thanks for calling. Good to hear from you, and good to hear you voicing support for this model and for putting responsible people in the lives of these individuals. I think the more that we can all, you know, ever do to act proactively and prevent is always time and energy well spent. And, you know, what we do know is there are some individuals who, have for whatever reason slipped through, you know, that preventative fabric, even if we continue to build it, which I hope we do. And at least it's good to know that we have a model that really serves as a public safety net as we go forward. I'd like us to work on both ends of the spectrum.
All right. And I wanted to ask a little bit or throw out, we haven't talked about the cost of this program and the fact that I know that the Department of Corrections has gotten some significant grant funding to expand this. Talk about what this program costs compared to incarceration and how might it be expanded?
Well, it's a bargain. It's a good deal because at the end of the line here are volunteers. This is a decidedly non-professional model. As Kathy mentioned, it's supervised by reentry coordinators at community justice centers. But COSA costs essentially about $12,500 based on our federal grant rate that we actually grant money to justice centers
per
for.
Per team?
Per COSA. And it costs about $50,000 annually, more or less, to keep an adult male incarcerated in state. So,
the
math is pretty stunning, and the results in terms of the recidivism really bear it out that it's time and money much better spent.
And Kathy Fox, now that you've done your first report, I know that you're going to be looking at a more extensive report. Mm-hmm. How do you think this program can be expanded in Vermont?
Well, I think we just need more volunteers. So I hope people will, after listening to this, sign up and extend it to more different kinds of offenders. And anyone who needs support could benefit from it. And I think the fact that people should realize that 95% of people who go to prison eventually come out, and they will be living in our communities. And anything we can wrap around them to help them transition is a good thing. So I would love to see it expanded to all different kinds of offenders.
Derek, do you think that's going to be the biggest limiting factor, finding volunteers that are willing to make this time commitment?
I think actually, nothing breeds success like success. So I think if anything, we're on a path to really amplifying the great results we're seeing, and people tell their neighbors, and we socially network a new way of ensuring public safety. So I'm looking forward to the future of this.
Well, we'll leave it there. I want to thank both of my guests for taking part. Kathy Fox is Associate Professor of Sociology at UVM. She's also a criminologist. Derek Miodovnik is the Community and Restorative Justice Executive for the Vermont Department of Corrections. Thank you both very much.
Thank you for having us.
Still to come, our next in our series of Dorothy's List, we'll get to that in just a bit. Stay with us on Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. Jane Lindholm is on maternity leave. I'm Nina Kack. Each month this school year, we've been bringing you stories about the books that are nominated for the Dorothy Canfield Fisher Children's Book Award. The winning book is selected each year by Vermont middle school students who read and discuss the 30 nominees on the DCF list. Today in our series, Dorothy's List, we meet author R.J. Palacio. Her novel, Wonder, tells the story of a fifth grader named August who, because of a facial deformity, has to navigate a social minefield at school. For this installment of Dorothy's List, VPR's Amy Noyes talked with students at Robinson Elementary School in Starksboro and posed their questions to the author.
Yeti. When these fifth and sixth graders hear the word Yeti, they know it's time to quiet down and pay attention. Today's lesson is about precepts, rules to live by. Each of the students came up with their own precept and designed a bumper sticker around it. Some students wrote precepts that are personal goals. Others, like fifth grader Charlotte Doyle, chose a precept from the book Wonder.
It's not enough to be friendly, you have to be a friend. Because August, a lot of people were being friendly to him, but not exactly his friend.
August Pullman is the main character in R.J. Palacio's book, Wonder. He's a fifth grader who's just going to school for the first time. August has been homeschooled his entire life, and Wonder chronicles the school year and his struggles to fit in, make friends, and thrive. Precepts play an important role in Wonder. August's English teacher gives the class a new precept to think about each month, delivering consequential life lessons. Sixth grader Eric McKean wants to know why the author decided to include precepts in the book.
Where did the idea for precepts come from?
We put Eric's question to author R.J. Palacio.
I used to collect precepts when I was about 14, 15 years old. I had a scrapbook, and I have absolutely no idea what compelled me to start the scrapbook. But I was a huge reader, and whenever I would find a phrase from a book or something that just kind of hit me for whatever reason, something that just made me feel like it was worth remembering, I would write it down in the scrapbook. I just thought it would be a great way, if I were a teacher, it would be a great way of introducing sort of the unit of essay writing and also talking about larger themes and essential virtues, kind of like trying to elevate the conversation a little bit about what we expect of kids in terms of old-fashioned virtues like kindness and tolerance and just notions like that that I'm not sure are stressed as much anymore when kids get older.
And Palacio says she loves the fact that her book has inspired some teachers, like Robinson School's Liz Greenberg, to use precepts in the classroom.
I'm really actually very tickled by the notion that teachers all across the country are now actually using precepts as in their classes. It's great.
August, or Augie as he's sometimes called, starts out as the book's narrator. But Starksboro sixth grader Abby Iliff is curious about how Palacio changes the narrator throughout the story.
Why did you decide to have different parts of the book told from different characters' perspectives?
Well, in order to tell Augie's story completely, I realized that I had to leave Augie's head a little bit. I mean, Augie's a great kid. He's really smart and intuitive, and he knows a lot about the impact he has on people in terms of, you know, how they react to him. But I don't think he's really aware of how much of an impact he has on people indirectly. And so in order to be able to tell his story, I realized that I would have to tell it from the points of view of the very people that he does impact. And so I expanded the narration to include other people's points of view, people that he encounters. And this way we can get a completely rounded view of who Augie Pullman is and what he has to say.
One section is narrated by a character named Justin. He's the new boyfriend of Augie's big sister. Starksboro teacher Liz Greenberg reads the scene where Justin meets Augie.
The first time I meet Olivia's little brother, I have to admit I'm totally taken by surprise. I shouldn't be, of course. Olivia's told me about his syndrome, has even described what he looks like. But she's also talked about all his surgeries over the years, so I guess I assumed he'd be more normal looking by now. Like when a kid is born with a cleft lip and has plastic surgery to fix it, sometimes you can't even tell except for the little scar above the lip. I guess I thought her brother would have some scars here and there, but not this. I definitely wasn't expecting to see this little kid in a baseball cap who's sitting in front of me right now. I like to think I'm able to hide my surprise. I hope I do. Surprise is one of those emotions that can be hard to fake, though. Whether you're trying to look surprised when you're not, or trying to not look surprised when you are.
But not everyone is conscientious about how they react to Augie, and some of Augie's classmates are downright mean. The worst offender is a middle school bully named Julian. He's one of the first kids Augie meets at his new school, and fifth grader Charlotte Doyle wants to know why R.J. Palacio didn't write any chapters from his point of view.
Why didn't you have Julian narrate a section and give his side of the story?
Well, that's a great question, and it's something I thought long and hard about. And ultimately, I decided not to give Julian a voice because it felt like giving a bully a pulpit in a way. I didn't want to do that. I didn't want to have him have a platform where he could try to rationalize or justify his meanness, because there really is no rationale and there is no justification for the way he treats Augie. But we might hear from him in some other way at some point in the future.
Fifth grader Emily LaRocque asks our next question, and it's something a lot of readers are curious about. We had a similar question posted to our website from Kieran, a student at BFA Fairfax Middle School.
What gave you the idea to write about a kid with facial deformities? Did you get it from a real-life person?
I was inspired to write the book by an encounter I had with a little girl who was probably around 6 or 7, and she looked very much the way I describe Augie as looking in the book. And I was with my two young sons, and my younger son, who was about 3 years old at the time, well, he was very afraid, and he started to cry. And at the time, I didn't know what to do, and I kind of panicked, and I thought the answer, the solution, was to leave the scene as quickly as possible. But afterwards, I felt terribly because I realized that I'd actually missed this wonderful opportunity to use this situation as a teaching moment for my children, to have shown them that there was nothing to be afraid of. And that got me thinking a lot about what it must be like to have to face a world every day that doesn't know how to face you back. So I started writing Wonder that very night.
Sixth grader Hope Levitt wonders what caused Augie's facial deformities.
Is the gene that Augie has real? Did you have to research it to be able to write about it?
I did research it, and he has a combination of two different syndromes. One of them is real. It's the Treacher-Collins syndrome, and I'm pretty sure that the girl that I saw probably had Treacher-Collins. Then in the book, Augie actually has another syndrome, which is kind of a mystery syndrome that just kind of makes everything worse for him. And I did that as a way of just making him truly unique in the world.
The way Augie looks is not described in great detail, leaving a lot up to the reader's imagination. Fifth grader Isabel Gaffney noticed the cartoon line drawing of Augie shows a kid with a face that's mostly blank.
Why wasn't there a picture of Augie somewhere in the cover of the book?
I knew that this book would definitely pose a challenge because it's a conundrum. On the one hand, a lot of books for children will show very detailed paintings of what the main characters look like, or illustrations, or drawings, or even a photograph. On the other hand, if we had done that with Wonder, you know, we didn't want to risk alienating some readers who might not get past the cover in order to read the book. And the truth is, a lot of times people need to read the entire book to be able to really get past what Augie looks like. So, you know, I think it was a wonderful choice on the part of the designer and the art director to decide to use a very iconic but abstract representation of what Augie would look like.
There's a lot for readers to take away from Wonder. Starkesboro sixth grader Addie Harris is curious what R.J. Palacio hopes her readers will remember.
What was the moral of the story that you were trying to get out to people?
I was going for just a reminder that we should just be kind to one another, and that's it. And it's very simple, but it's the notion that if everybody were just a little kinder than necessary, the world really would be a better place.
And kindness is a notion that rings true for the fifth and sixth graders at Robinson Elementary School and many other classrooms around the country. So far, more than 26,000 young readers have signed an online Wonder Pledge to think about kindness when making everyday decisions. Middle school is not always a kind place, as the character Augie experienced firsthand. But by the end of the school year, he's learned a lot about how to negotiate that tough environment. And many of his classmates learned to live the precept, it's not enough to be friendly, you have to be a friend. For VPR News, I'm Amy Noyes.
The book is Wonder by New York City author R.J. Palacio. And you can link to the Choose Kind Pledge, see the cover art for Wonder, and also see some of the Starkesboro students with their precept bumper stickers on VPR.net. Just click on Dorothy's List. Next month in our Dorothy's List series, The Boy on Cinnamon Street by Vermont author Phoebe Stone. Here's a preview read by Carmen Isabel, an eighth grader at Stowe Middle School.
I'm just getting home from school thinking about how my grandma used to say I used to be very poetic. Sunsets used to be my all-time favorite. Now I hate them. I used to get all high scores in the artistic part of the gymnastics routine. Now I hate gymnastics. Everything was different before when I lived on Cinnamon Street. I'm just going up the steps to our condo. Suddenly I stop. Boom! I can't believe this. Someone has drawn a big heart in pink chalk on the cement porch in front of our door. A heart? What?
That's an excerpt from The Boy on Cinnamon Street. It's the next book in our monthly series, Dorothy's List, about the books nominated for the Dorothy Canfield Fisher Children's Book Award. Dorothy's List is sponsored by the VPR Journalism Fund. And we're still getting emails about the COSA program. Megan wrote in, I've been working for 10 years with folks coming back from incarceration. I have so many stories of people just getting overwhelmed with everything on the outside and giving up, often committing a low-level crime to go back to jail. I wholeheartedly believe in this program and that it's not just a benefit from the ex-offender, but to all of us.
It's amazing to sit in meetings with our core member and volunteers and listen to the sharing that happens. We each have things to offer our core member, but he has also given us wisdom and energy. Back to the group. We'd love to hear from you. You can comment on our webpage, like us on Facebook, or email us at vermontedition@vpr.net. And that's it for today. Tomorrow, Bob Kinzel will kick off the new legislative season with a live broadcast from the State House in Montpelier. We'll talk to leaders from the House as they prepare for the 2014 session. Vermont Edition is produced by Patty Daniels, Rick Singeri, and Sage Van Wing, with production assistance from Tim Johnson. I'm Nina Keck. Thanks for listening.